Record on the computer. Good afternoon. This is Michael Vandervoort. It's August 11th. We're creeping through the dog days of August. It's hot here in Florida. I imagine it's hot everywhere, but we're headed towards the fall and maybe some temperature relief. But in the meantime, things stay hot in the world of labor relations. And so I am here with my podcast co-host, John Hyman. John, we're doing another, our second episode of Labor Relatedly. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm good. As we chatted about, you know, online before, I was out of the state of Florida last week elsewhere on some business and a bit of vacation. So that was cool. Now I'm back here and it's busy as hell and so on and so on. But there's a lot going on in the world of labor relations. And I thought we, you know, in order to keep up, you know, we said once a month, but it's been a 2-3 weeks and there are at least 3 or 4 things for us to talk about today. So I thought maybe we should get together and you were available. So you want to get started. And as our co-host and also our special labor law correspondent, so that we give all due credit here. I think the first thing we were going to talk about is actually about a week old, and it's a little esoteric because it involves sports, and sports labor relations are always a little bit different because of celebrities and it's millionaires on billionaires and that kind of stuff. But we got Deshaun Watson and a really interesting decision by an arbitrator, which is
a story near and dear to my heart as I sit here.
No doubt.
Yes, my hometown quarterback, love it or not.
Do you find yourself conflicted by that? Like in terms of like he's a brilliant talent, I guess, although he sat out last year. And the Browns have a kind of a team on the rise with a lot of talent. So this guy could be a piece, kind of like what we saw with Brady when he came to the Buccaneers down here in Tampa a couple years ago. But Brady came with baggage, but not like Deshaun Watson.
No, this is baggage of a whole other kind. Conflicted, yeah. I think a lot of us here in Cleveland feel conflicted. I think what you will find is that if Deshaun Watson ends up playing the season and the Browns win 10, 11, 12 games, make a run in the playoffs, all the conflicts for a lot of people are going to fall by the wayside. I think it's easy to take a stand, and then once the team starts winning, this team that you love your whole life and has been a perennial disappointment, all of a sudden you'll be right back on the bandwagon. But I'm very conflicted. I wish that the Browns had put morals over winning, which is I understand a rarity in those sports because winning is everything and winning leads to dollars, and dollars is what drives all this. So I get it. I just wish that it was one of the other, whatever, 31 teams or 30 teams that had taken a flyer on Deshaun Watson, because I think it sends a signal, that a strong signal, that we value winning over everything, including the safety of however many of the women you want to believe. And the disciplinary officer that heard Deshaun Watson's case from the NFL, Sue Robinson, was a retired federal judge. There were only 4 of the, whatever, 24, I think, women that have accused him of sexual misconduct, sexual assault. She heard only 4 of those cases were before her, but she believed just about, you know, she said in her opinion that she believed in all the women's stories. So it's like this arbitrator is dealing with, that's troubling.
Sorry, I'm having a little bit of can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, sorry, I was having a little bit of connectivity here for a second on my headset, I think. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay.
So as you said, 24, maybe 27, I don't know the exact details. Not that it's insignificant, right? But it was a double digits, you know, a lot of women who filed complaints about it, about harassment and, you know, mistreatment, and there was a settlement, I guess, settlements reached, which the details really aren't, you know, available for, but I'm presuming they included non-disclosure agreements from most of the people that
probably
settled.
Yeah. Probably, yeah. And so, it was all but one. Deshaun Watson settled cases, but all but one.
Yeah. So there were 3 women, I think, who refused to settle, and 1 who maybe settled but didn't have an NDA or something. And so the arbitrator, this Sue Ellen Robinson, really had a limited array of evidence that she could consider in this hearing. And I thought maybe what were the right place to start is, you know, a lot of HR professionals hear about arbitrations, but they don't really understand how they work. And this isn't a classic labor union type arbitration that an employer would have, because it's a little bit of a special referee or whatever. But can you just kind of maybe lay out for us from a legal perspective how what arbitration is and how it works real quick, and then we'll talk about like her decision.
Yeah, I mean, it is essentially a trial for all intents and purposes, with a couple of key differences. Difference number one is there's no judge or jury. The finder of fact and the ultimate decider is the arbitrator. That's number one. Number two, the arbitrator is supposed to be bound by the provisions of the collective bargaining agreement being interpreted or applied. And importantly, and it's I think it comes into play in the Deshaun Watson case, is supposed to be guided by past practice. And there's really, unlike a trial in a state or federal court, where if you don't like the result, you can appeal to an appellate court. Your right to appeal here in a labor arbitration is very, very, very limited. And the odds of you actually succeeding on an appeal are even more limited. So that for all intents and purposes, the arbitrator's decision is final. The NFL case with Deshaun Watson's a little different in that either side here did have a right under the collective bargaining agreement to appeal the decision. The NFL Player Association on Watson's behalf did not. The NFL has, saying that the 6 games that he was awarded was too light of a suspension. They thought an indefinite suspension of at least a year was warranted under the circumstances. And so Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, has deferred to a supposedly neutral third party who will issue a decision. And that decision will essentially be final with limited appeal rights from that ultimate decision.
Yeah, and from a labor law perspective, again, with it, you know, the fact that it's sports. So in recent years, the last several years, most of these kind of decisions related to player misconduct, most of those suspensions and or punishments were handed down by Commissioner Goodell just sort of arbitrarily. He just kind of did whatever he felt like doing. And he had a wildly inconsistent record of you know, assessing, you know, 17 games, a full season for somebody placing a bet on his own team to win, which, you know, gambling is always viewed, you know, with great animosity by sports leagues. But that's not the most heinous crime in the world. And especially when you compare it to, you know, what might be 24, 25, 30 cases of sexual assault and or worse. Right. And right. That guy, Calvin Ridley, gets 17 games and, you know, Deshaun Watson with a different judge or different arbitrator gets 6. I mean, but there's tons of stuff like that going back. So that's one of the reasons that I think that the league and the Players Association kind of agreed to try this new arbitrator option was to try to bring a little bit more consistency to the process because they've sucked at it basically.
Yeah. And that's what they're trying to do. I think my problem, and this is in no way it designed or meant to condone what Deshaun Watson did or is accused of doing, which is horrific and inexcusable. And as I said before, I'm not happy with the fact that he's quarterbacking my team with a $250 million contract backing him. But the collective bargaining agreement here, to me, is very problematic for the NFL. The agreement, and I have it open in front of me, so I'm going to quote what I think is the key passage. The agreement says, quote, ownership and club or league management have traditionally been held to a higher standard and will be subject to more significant discipline when violations of the personal conduct policy occur, close quote. And the NFL has a horrific track record of holding ownership, white ownership to account for ownership's violation of the league's personal conduct policy. And there are numerous examples. You have Bob Kraft of the New England Patriots, who was actually indicted for he was caught in a prostitution sting at a Florida massage parlor and was actually under indictment. Mm-hmm. The charges were ultimately dropped because of some constitutional issues with search and seizure. But he was actually indicted. Deshaun Watson, not indicted. Two different grand juries refused to indict him on anything right. criminal. Dan Snyder, the owner of the Washington, what are they called now? The Commanders?
Commanders.
The Washington Commanders, accused of sexually assaulting female employees and other instances of sexual harassment. Jerry Jones, the owner of the Cowboys, accused of sexual misconduct of a female employee. So if your agreement says you're going to hold ownership to the same or more significant higher standard for their violations of the personal conduct policy, and they got off with nothing, it seems to me, when you're letting white ownership off with nothing to give the black player anything, to me smacks of discrimination, protecting the old boys club, whatever you want to call it. But to me, particularly if I read this morning that we may get a decision on the NFL's appeal of the six games as early as next week. If that ends up being indefinite suspension or a season long suspension or whatever, I think we will see litigation in federal court. I think it's going to put people like Bob Kraft and Dan Snyder front and center, and it's not a good look for the NFL at all.
Yeah, exactly. There's no chance it would be less than six games, I guess. I was going to ask if there's any kind of appeal that Watson would have, but I think it's either take the six games or maybe appeal the next level. I don't know how that,
he chose not to appeal it. I think, he and the NFLPA chose not to appeal the six games. So I think I think they've accepted that and waived any argument that that's too harsh.
I guess where I was going is if somehow the league wins, I don't know the process, and I'm not sure that you do either. I wonder if there's an appeal there, or would he have to go into court maybe saying that it gets really esoteric.
I have read that the decision of the commissioner's office, which he has offloaded to this third party, the decision of the commissioner's office is final.
Okay.
No appeal rights, but the NFLPA has already said that if the suspension is made more severe, they will file a lawsuit in federal court.
Yeah, that's kind of what I figured.
To vacate the decision.
So once they get out of this arbitrator, it goes to it could go to court. That's correct. Typically not the case in a standard, more collective bargaining based arbitration process. Once the arbitrator issues those decisions, those are typically, I mean, rarely you can take them into court, but it's so incidental that it's almost never happens, right?
Yeah. And it just, I'm not sure what the NFL is trying to, I know what they're trying to accomplish here. They think that he should be punished more severely. I get that. But when you have Deshaun Watson's team saying, raising the names of people like Bob Kraft and Dan Snyder, and when you have the arbitrator, Sue Robinson herself, making reference to it albeit in a footnote, but a reference to it in her written decision, why the NFL wants to take the chance of all of this dirty laundry about their history of giving their owners a pass for their own acts or allegations of sexual misconduct, to me, is I just don't understand why they want to risk having all that dirty laundry aired in a courtroom in a federal lawsuit. It makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah, I heard an excellent point by some, I don't remember the name of that sports analyst, but like on an ESPN or something, who said that effectively with this appeal, they've made this whole upcoming season going to be the discussion is going to be Deshaun Watson, and even regardless of how it turns out with the appeal, they've kind of tainted the whole season from a set of letting it sort of just settle down and deal with it as this in the system that they set up themselves. So anyway,
yeah, and you know, and like I said, if you know, if Deshaun Watson takes the Browns to the Super Bowl this year or next year or whatever, at least in the city of Cleveland, it'll be all sins forgiven for Deshaun. There'll be a statue of him in the middle of public square, so it will be everything forgiven. Unfortunately,
well, let's hope that he at least maybe learned to be a better person out of all this, but that isn't always the case either. So there's another legal, another big legal thing that came out earlier this week, I think, out of New York State, which involves the restaurant chain Chipotle, which we talked a little bit on our last show related to union organizing in Augusta, Maine. But this isn't about union organizing. This is about a big labor law judgment, $20 million settlement for several thousand employees in New York State over pay and scheduling change laws that exist in the state of New York. So this isn't something that impacts every practitioner across the US, but it's a growing trend, these kinds of legislation where the state passes a law that guarantees people, you know, set schedules and so on, makes it really difficult for some businesses to manage their schedules. But in this case, at least, it comes with a huge cost. So I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at that case or not.
I did. The number obviously jumps off the page anytime you see that many zeros in a settlement. And that's not even that's the settlement. I think the alleged violations totaled something like $150 million. I think that was just the back pay. And then there was, you know, penalties and liquidated damages and everything on top of that. And so to settle a case for $20 million obviously causes, you know, it's jaw dropping, that number. This comes out of what are called fair scheduling laws, where you're supposed to, you know, give employees, you know, notice of their scheduling. You're supposed to make shifts available to current employees before you go hiring new employees, which does things like potentially bring overtime into play for workers, where instead of, and it prevents you from getting out of obligations like your Affordable Care, you know, health insurance obligations to employees. So you're, instead of having two employees at 20 hours, if you have enough work for one employee at 40, you're supposed to schedule that one employee to hire another to fill that, you know, to fill the gap. And so it is just a jaw-dropping number. State of New York, I think, probably comes in close, you know, it's not quite California, but it's in terms of their employment laws and aggressiveness, it's maybe a distant second, but still second to California. And, you know, as you said, these laws aren't on the books everywhere, but I think to tie into the overall topic of what we're trying to accomplish here with this show, it gives the union a really good talking point, as the union is, you know, Chipotle is in the, you know, at least on the radar for labor unions that are organizing. There's at least one that has attempted to have been organized so far.
I think there's two total, one that got closed.
Right.
Yeah.
But it gives the union a talking point, right? That, you know, your employer is ripping off your coworkers in another state to the tune of, you know, $150 million, and they agreed to settle for $20 million. And it gives the union a really good talking point that, frankly, Chipotle, the counter argument is not a great one for Chipotle to make, since they agreed to pay $20 million to settle the claim.
Yeah, and these laws require, like you said, some stability. They generally, I mean, I haven't read them. I've just read kind of summaries, but they generally create a situation where, like, if you are a fast food restaurant or retailer, you know, you have to assign like 14 days of schedule and give us like a 7-day notice of change. So there's some, you know, I don't know what you do if somebody calls in sick or whatever, right? I think there are steps in there, but laws don't always comprehend the realities of business, I guess. So it creates a pretty burdensome system to manage under, especially in this environment that we're operating in right now, where help is hard to find in the first place. And people tend to just kind of, you know, as we say, ghost an employer or whatever, or just call off. There's a lot of that going on. So I can understand at a certain level how Chipotle got in, got in a bit of trouble, but this seems like it's exponentially larger than the average case that you would probably see, even under these relatively burdensome laws.
Yeah, you raise a really good point though, because if I'm a Chipotle or a fast food establishment, right, and my choices are scheduling employees to work 50 hours a week when they're telling me they don't want to do that and I risk them quitting, or hiring additional part-time help so I can keep my store open and when help is impossible to find, you're kind of finding labor where you can find it. And in this environment fueled by the great resignation, the great reshuffling, whatever you want to call it, where hiring and retaining are so difficult, it's hard to fault an employer from doing what it can to make sure it shifts recovered so that it can stay open and serve the public and make money, right? But that does kind of butt up against these very difficult scheduling laws that tell employers how they have to go about scheduling employees. But in this environment, you have to question whether those laws, at least for the time being, make sense, because employers are having a hard enough time as is.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're, you know, and the sad part is they're well-intentioned, trying to make people, you know, have like a more stable, you know, more predictable childcare. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why such laws,
you know,
the impetus for such laws makes sense. It doesn't, but it doesn't always line up with the real life situation of business, and thus creates problems. But I don't know. I can't imagine having to write a $20 million check though. That has to be one of one of the larger settlements I've seen in a long time. I don't know about you, but I don't remember seeing that number.
I'm trying to imagine being the lawyer recommending a $20 million settlement.
I guess if it's a $20 million settlement to escape 150, you know, I mean,
I have clients that choke when I recommend a $20,000 settlement. So $20 million, right. I can't imagine.
We don't play in the big leagues, John. I guess we're not that. I'm not a lawyer anyway, but I guess we just don't play in the big leagues. So
I'm sure I want to.
Yeah, no, I know that would be hard to live down for sure. So let's switch over. I know we're going kind of rolling through three or four topics today kind of quick, but the next two are a little more, they're not cases. They're more philosophical stuff. I was having a conversation last week on these next two topics, and these aren't things I spend a lot of time thinking about normally, but I thought they were both fascinating, and I just wanted to kind of tee them up and have a little discussion with you about them, because I think they are things that could, you know, come into play in practitioners' jobs. I was telling a couple stories, and I'll probably share one of them as an example of what I'm talking about. But so the first one is in the world of labor relations, when there's a labor union contract in effect, labor union has something that's called the affirmative duty of fair representation. They have to provide a minimum sort of representation to their members in every situation. So I didn't ask you about this. Do you want to kind of give the legal definition of what that is?
I mean, you just, the union has to act in good faith on behalf of its members. It can't turn a blind eye to, for example, processing grievances on behalf of a member or taking a case to arbitration. It has to act in its members' best interest. It's almost akin to a fiduciary obligation on the business side, but they kind of have to act in their members' best interest in their execution of their obligations under the agreement.
Yeah, and I have experienced in my career when I managed in a unionized facilities over the years, where from time to time, that creates an odd sort of conflict between the company and the union, and also potentially between the union and its various members. And I'll set up factually one of those cases that I remember, which, and I won't go into heavy detail on it, but it was kind of harkening back to the Deshaun Watson's case. It was a situation where a male employee, a rather short-term employee, given the tenure of many of our associates at that, or employees at that plant, was working on a second shift production line. This would have been in the 90s when biker, not motorcycle, but bicycling compression shorts were part of that, you know, flashy wardrobes along with baggy pants, right? Baggy shorts. So this young guy would walk along the production line and rather disturbingly walk up to any female employee he may run across and pull down his baggy shorts and display his compression shorts and what was underneath and, you know, say things like, boy, I bet you want some of that. And it was like, this happened night after night after night until finally somebody, you know, said enough. And they came and complained to me. We did an investigation, found, you know, had plenty of witnesses, fired the guy. Union grieved his termination. My boss, my head split open when this happened, but my boss reinstated this guy on a last chance agreement. And he went out and did, you know, and the union said, you know, basically it's last chance agreement. If he does it, you know, we'll drop it, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you guys didn't follow progressive discipline. I'm like, how do you follow progressive discipline for sexual? Anyway, termination, he was reinstated and I fired him again a week later, which ultimately stuck the second time. But I was really pissed that we had to bring it back. And my personal disgust over the situation was the union argued for the guy who was a clear, flagrant offender, right? And got him reinstated versus the interests of the, I bet the women he offended equaled in number to Sean. You know, there's 15 or 20 women that were involved in this complaint ultimately, right? And the unions set aside their interests in favor of the one who was a flagrant violator, and they won. You know, so if I was a union member, I'd be furious, especially if I was a female union.
If you're one of the victims, you're like, what about your obligation to me? Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So now I understand, given what you just said, it's a fiduciary responsibility, mandated by the act, mandated by their constitution and bylaws. So how do they parse that? Right. And I know you're not on the union side. Right. But like what's the right thing to do there? Because they're kind of in some sense, it's rocking a hard place. Right.
Yeah. And a lot of it will vary by union to union. Because I have had conversations with union reps, union local executives in cases very similar to the one that you just discussed.
Oh, this happens all the time.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. And it is, maybe it's guided by the union's constitution and bylaws. Maybe it's just guided by the personal preference of the union president or whomever. But I've had some unions tell me, look, we don't feel good about it, but we have a duty, you know, we have a duty of fair representation to the fired employee, and we're going to have to grieve his termination, and we're not going to lose any sleep if he doesn't get his job back, but we got to go through the process and do what we have to do. And I've heard others tell me that their duty is to all their members, not just to the individual, and they can't adequately meet their obligation to the victims, for example, if they're trying to get the alleged harasser his or her job back. I've seen unions do it both ways. What I don't know, now you piqued my curiosity, I'm going to take a look and maybe we'll give an update on our next show, is has a union ever been sued on a DFR, an alleged DFR violation by the victims, right? Pursuing the termination of the alleged harasser.
Yeah,
which would be a fascinating case.
That would. I'm not aware of any, but again, you know, it's not something that I deal with a lot, and it's not something that I follow. But I had this conversation, and the conversation was actually around the notion of maybe trying to somehow alter DFR to be more reflective of today's world, because
I mean, you have two statutes here that in the hypothetical that you or in the not so hypothetical the names have been changed to protect the guilty. The story that you ran through, which happens a lot, you got two statutes that are butting up against each other. You have the National Labor Relations Act, and you have Title VII, and if you're asking me, whether it's as if I'm guiding my clients or if I'm, or just as a matter of policy or philosophy or whatever, which if they're going to butt up against each other, which one gives and which one wins, I'm saying Title VII wins or should win 10 times out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what the National Labor, I don't care what the National Labor Relations Act says. If following the NLRA is going to cause me to create a discriminatory or hostile work environment in violation of some class protected by Title VII, race or the ADA or the AD, you know, pick your protected class,
mm-hmm.
you know, race, sex, age, disability, sexual orientation, religion, national origin, whatever, I'm protecting the individual rights of the employee over whatever collective rights the National Labor Relations Act is going to grant.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Anyway, so that I don't know that there's a way to resolve it. I mean, I guess you know, employers have to do a good job. You have to document. You have to do thorough invest. I mean, all the things that we normally do anyway in these situations, you have to deal with them in a union environment because you actually have a slightly higher bar that you have to overcome there in terms of the review at times with an arbitrator.
And you hope that, you know, if the case gets to court, we saw this wasn't a termination case, but it was with a unfair labor practice charge that I forget the employer. It was a tire manufacturer out of Western Ohio. And I forget the name of the dealer. Was it Dealer Tire? I don't remember. Anyway, but they had a strike where people crossed the picket lines, and some of the replacement workers that crossed the picket line were African American, and they were called the N word and had like watermelons thrown at them by the striking not white workers, and the employer fired the striking workers, saying we have an obligation to protect our employees, and the replacement workers are our employees, to protect them from a hostile work environment. You violated that, you're fired. And they found an unfair labor practice charge saying it was discriminatory. They were engaged in protected activity. And basically what they say on the picket line is protected. And I think they won at the board and lost in federal court. And the federal court ultimately said, if we're lining up competing policies between the right of strikers to have their say on a picket line versus the rights of replacement workers or other employees not to be harassed on account of their race, the rights of those not to be harassed on account of their race wins. So striking workers, you lose. You can't lob racial epithets at replacement workers with impunity and expect to be able to keep your job. And maybe when we're talking about the duty of fair representation, maybe what we need to see, if we're talking about some common sense reforms, is something that says that in a union, and whether this is a court decision done by court or by statute or by regulation, but something that says a union does not breach its duty of fair representation when the position it takes, you know, causes it, you know, not to violate a federal or state law against workplace discrimination or something like that.
Kind of ease the complete and total obligation in those situations where the actions are so egregious that they're clearly defined under another statute that waives the duty to represent to the extent, the full extent, if you deem it violating a law outside of the NLRA, and it's not in the best interest of the full body of the membership, maybe that, you know, they're not held to that same high standard that they are today.
Right.
Yeah. The other one that I thought was fascinating, and it's the most esoteric of the topics we'll talk about today, is the idea of taking a look at labor reform in general, but specifically Section 8A2 of the National Labor Relations Act, and it's actually a rather long section, but so I'm going to play lawyer for a minute, since I have the section open. So for those that don't know the act by heart, which even I don't for sure, Section 8A2 of the Act makes it an unfair labor practice for an employer to dominate or interfere with the formation and administration of any labor organization or contribute financial or other support to it. So you can't establish or control a company union or recognize a union after you've been notified of a valid petition for election. You can't go find another union and cut a deal with them. And, you know, there's a number of other things in there. It basically says the company shall not have the ability to interfere with the union. But in other countries, and most notably Germany, for example, they have things called works councils. And we're seeing this trend in the US. We had worker centers, and now we're seeing a lot of these independent unions at some of these companies, like we talked about in our last show. And even more so, we're seeing just, I don't know how to explain it. We're seeing groups of employees at a company who are not trying to unionize, but they're stepping up to advocate about their employment relationship and they don't want to be in a union, but they want to have a voice. And so this notion of 8A2, a reasonable employer, and a reasonable employer might actually entertain a conversation with their associates about working conditions, but it could violate the law. So
a reasonable employer is going to want to listen to their employees because they're going to want to keep those concerns in-house rather than forcing the employees outside of the company to talk to a labor organizer who then can then come in and voice those concerns on their behalf. So it's absolutely in the employer's best interest if the employees want to get together and organize within the workplace to then present through committee or otherwise to the employer a list of concerns to say, you know, these are the pressure points. This is where we think we can do better as an organization. An employer should listen because the employees are telling you what's going to improve their workplace. And if you're not going to listen, a union might, and that's what you're trying to avoid.
Yeah. But depending on how it's done, there's a lot of gray area there, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You can listen, but you can't basically, like, you can listen, but you can't promise to do it. You can't do anything about it. So, I'm oversimplifying. But if your goal as the employer is to kind of have these committees be kind of a de facto arm of management to help management make decisions, then they're going to be illegal. If you're just listening and then they're maybe legal with a ton of gray area in the middle.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you a typical client question, right? I have a safety committee at my plant. Is that illegal?
Probably not. But again, it's going to depend on how it's set up and then what the management participation looks like.
So, by the way, I don't have a safety committee at my plant because I don't have a plant. So I don't have a safety committee. It was hypothetical, but just for disclosure. I've worked in facilities where we had safety committees in non-union facilities, and, you know, you would quite often walk the floor with, you know, managers, right? The safety manager, or the HR manager, or shift supervisors would quite often walk the floor with representatives from the company, volunteers from the safety committee, and you would mutually review and audit the departments that you were walking through, looking for, you know, not violations per se, but looking to make sure that things were being followed, lockout, tagout, all that kind of stuff. That's pretty common in a lot of business today. And I don't think anybody's looking to, like, you know, file ULPs over safety committee, but there is a line when you start getting into things in a non-union environment. There's a line when you start talking about things like benefits or work rules and stuff. So can you maybe give us, like, where the break points are, where you might be okay and where you might not be? I know it's not black and white.
Yeah, it's not black and white. I mean, the question the question really becomes like how much say do the employees have? Are they, for example, just making proposals, or are they actually sitting down with management and helping to formulate policies? Are they actual proposals that management can act on, or is it So I guess if you're saying kind of where's the line, I guess is the employee committee or employee group or employee body, is it merely providing information for management for its benefit that it can or cannot act on, or is it making proposals kind of independent of or in conjunction with management in which there's an expectation of change occurring?
So if the group of hourly employees comes forward with a suggestion about, we think we should be scheduled in this way according to this system, and management says, well, we can't do that, but we could alter it, you know, then you've kind of engaged in a sort of quasi bargaining,
right?
And that's probably going to get you in trouble. If you go to a group of employees and say, here are three options that we've crafted of shift schedules, and we'd like your impression. I mean, that could go sideways depending on the circumstances, but that's more likely to be just because you're soliciting feedback.
Correct. And, or if the employees come to you and say, we don't like the way schedules are done. We've done some research on how it's done at other companies. Here's some potential options for you to consider, or something like that. Thanks for listening. And then management kind of takes the information, either does something with it or doesn't. That to me seems more informational as opposed to the collaborative expectation of doing something as a result of the employees raising these concerns.
So the conversation that we had led was. Would it make sense to, since these kind of dialogues have a direct impact on both sides, if you will, whether there's a union in place or not, would it be a good policy reform for labor policy in the U.S. to consider relaxing that standard in some way? And I think at the beginning of this, you said, yeah, having that direct discussion is the right thing to do. But would you say, in your opinion, that maybe trying to loosen it up a little bit could add some additional advantages, or would it open up some other doors I haven't thought about?
No, to me it seems advantageous for both sides. The only group that may oppose it is the labor unions, because it runs against their interests, right? If you can deal directly with management on some issues, maybe not issues like wages and. But if you can deal with management on some issues that are kind of key to the workplace, the need for the labor union to do that on the employee's behalf shrinks, right? So
yeah,
the group that's going to oppose it, I think, if you're talking about some common sense 8A2 reforms, the group that's going to oppose it is going to be big labor. And if I'm advocating on behalf of management, if I'm SHRM or some other management trade organization, employer trade organization, I'm saying, I think this is a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Although, I go back to what I said at the beginning, like in Germany with the works councils, I mean, there is negotiations that happens between the union and the company, but then there's also this guidance role that is created with a works council where they do solicit input on this kind of stuff on a regular basis as a part of, but it's not done under the auspices of the collective bargaining agreement. It's more like the works councils exist to provide guidance during the terms of the contract related to certain issues or business development. And I don't know. I don't know if that would work in the U.S. because, you know, we tend to hate anything that looks European anyway. Not, I mean, not in general, but of policy stuff, right? That we, you know, don't make the U.S. Europe is.
I was going to say beer, pizza.
Yeah, we like
croissants.
That, food, fashion, movies. But, you know, policies that we tend to reject out of hand. Just it's European. We don't like it. I'm generalizing in a big way at the end of the show here today. I'm not saying that would work, but I do think it's an interesting concept, right? And it's just one, you know, because I think what we're seeing is some sort of evolution, right, with the employees, with labor to a certain extent. We're seeing changes in the way they're doing some things, but it's not going to happen fast, and it's not going to happen easily. But it's just interesting to kind of contemplate how, you know, instead of trying to pass the PRO Act or whatever, which would radically change everything, could we change a few bits and pieces and maybe make our system slightly more effective for everybody?
It depends what goal you're trying to achieve. If your goal is to make it easier for unions to organize and to help bolster labor unions as businesses, then the PRO Act makes a lot of sense. If your goal is to make workplaces better for employees, then something like loosening the 8A2 standard to give employees maybe a little more say, or the opportunity to have a little more say in what goes on in the workplace without, without violating 8A2, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. That's what I thought too. It'll never happen, or at least it won't happen anytime soon, but I thought it was an interesting discussion. I think that we're almost through an hour that we booked. So I didn't mean to run the show quite that long, but fascinating discussion today, at least for me and you. I wanted to mention my other co-host, Robin Schooling, on our regular episodes of Drive Through HR. Released the first episode of a new at least 10-part series that she's running that ties into the world of recruiting and recruiting technology. Her guest is Aaron Backman, and that episode was posted, I don't know, a couple days ago. So if you're interested in hearing anything outside of the labor relations world and you're into recruiting, Robin's started a new show. We've kind of split up for a while, like I split up the band, and we're going off and working with other artists to spur our creativity, I guess. But anyway, this was episode number 2 of Labor.
Does that make me Yoko?
Yeah, you know, you're the muse. Yeah, you're the inspiration, so something like that. I don't know. Anyway, this is episode number 2 of Labor Relatedly, and this is Michael Vandervoort and my co-host John Hyman. And thanks for listening. And John, I hope you have a great rest of the week.
Yeah, you too. We'll do this again soon.
Yeah, we'll catch up. There's plenty to talk about every couple of weeks. So have a good day. Talk to you soon.
Take care.